The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap.
In this three-part series, Commander Elena Youngblood sits down with Dr. Martin Mandelberg to discuss his experience working with Dr. Richard Hamming as his one and only PhD student. Dr. Mandelberg recounts all his trials, tribulations, and challenges in working with a personality such as Dr. Hamming, as well as the special, cherished connection he shared with his mentor. He states that it was this chosen family bond that drove him to undertake his current massive project involving coordination with the Hamming family estate to preserve all manner of documentation from Dr. Hamming, both in an accessible online archive and in his new book, Richard Wesley Hamming. Part 1 of a 3-part series.
Welcome back, friends. My name is Elena Youngblood, and I'm one of the hosts here at the Trident Room podcast. And today I have a very special guest, Martin. And Martin has done a lot of things in his career, one of which was he was a student here at NPS. And he actually had the advisee of Hamming, the person that we have our supercomputer named after. And we're going to get into all of that here in a second. But I would like to kind of give a little bit of a background that I have for you and expand, as I said, as you wish. So I have here that you earned a BS in electrical engineering from Drexel University. Then you earned 2 master's degrees, one in electrical engineering from the University of Connecticut, and one in strategy and national security studies from the U.S. Naval War College. Then, after working for the Coast Guard and the Naval Underwater Systems, you earned a PhD here in electrical engineering, and that's where you were advised by Mr. Richard Hamming. Then you went on to work for the U.S. government in the Office of the Secretary of Defense before starting your own company, Mandelberg Consulting. So this is the barest nutshell of your background. Is there anything that you'd like to expand upon before we launch into these questions that you have not seen before?
Thank you very much. I just want to correct something that ChatGPT missed when giving you that on me. When I left government service in 1987, I had a 20-year service in industry at a defense contractor called Science Applications International Corporation. No, actually, it's SAIC. You would not call IBM IBM. You don't pronounce the acronym.
It's the military in me. That's how we go.
I understand. So I was at SAIC starting as a strategist for the president of the company, Dr. J. Robert Beister, and I ended up as a C-level officer on the board of directors with 300 direct reports, and the company grew from 5,000 people to 43,000 people. During the time I was there, I claim that I didn't prevent it from going higher or lower, but I contributed.
I love it. Okay, thank you so much for that addition. Starting off, what kind of problems fascinated you when you were young? And do any of those early questions still echo in your work today?
Well, I'm currently 78 years old. Is that right? Born in 1946. So I'm coming up to a 79th birthday in October. My work now is mentorship and writing and enjoying 7 grandchildren and 1 great-grandson. The problems that I had, I was an innovator. I was curious. Like many boys who grew up in the 50s and 60s, I played with Erector sets and early electronics. I was enamored by electronics, hence my career in electrical engineering. I built Heathkit shortwave radio. I was a shortwave radio monitor, and a stereo system did not electrocute anybody to the best of my knowledge. But there were the normal things that don't always work right the first time you put it together and it goes up in a puff of smoke. So I made some of my mistakes early in life, and I still reserve the right to make a couple of more mistakes because I'm curious. So if I had to add a word, I would say I was curious. I was driven to excel. I grew up in a blue-collar family. My sister and I are the first to go to college. My parents did not go to college. And I became an engineer and have enjoyed a wonderful career.
Wow. That's really cool. I did not realize that your parents didn't go to college. So you've taken full advantage of
The American dream. My grandparents came to America through Ellis Island from the current countries of Ukraine, Poland, and Austria. Back then, it was called Galicia. They came 1890 to 1904, Eastern European Jews. And my parents stressed education and self-reliance. And I was the youngest son of two lovely people, and they brought me upright.
Awesome. You've moved across disciplines, institutions, and sectors. What internal compass helped you navigate through such different intellectual climates?
I would say a word that we're going to come back to later on is mentors. I wanted to work for, learn from the best I could reach. So the harder courses in high school, the harder courses in undergraduate school, where I could get to a full proper professor, not a teaching assistant who just taught me what was in the book. I could do that. When I got to a great professor, I soared. And those were I would get better grades. When I either worked for a lesser person, I don't mean that in the pejorative, but a person who could not help me grow, I was less interested. When I worked with or took a course from a professor who stretched my mind, I ate it all up. So that was undergraduate and grad school and all the way here to NPS.
Was there a formative moment where you realized that the way you think didn't quite fit the system you were in? And if so, what did you do with that realization?
In undergraduate school in electrical engineering at Drexel, which is now Drexel University, back then it was Drexel Institute of Technology, I was one of 400 incoming freshmen in electrical engineering. So it's a big private school. Only 108 graduated in electrical engineering. It was difficult. There were only four disciplines of engineering: chemical, electrical, mechanical. Now there's 18. How do I know? My grandson graduated 7 years ago from my alma mater. Yeah, and he did better grades than I do. But grades are not important. Mm-hmm. What's important is your ability to learn how to learn, which is what Richard Wesley Hamming did in his last capstone book, which is available on YouTube at Calhoun. Those professors and those employers who stretched my mind to be curious, to be innovative, to know, for example, if something worked, why did it work? And if something didn't work, did I cause it not to work? Or was it a quality failure in the parts I was assembling? Hamming's quote in his first book was, "The purpose of computing is insight, not numbers." If you compute the number 7, what does that mean? Are you going to do something, not do something? How accurate is the 7? I built electronics in high school, in undergraduate school, and on the job for the Navy. And I pushed the limits of what they could do and was aptly rewarded for 8 inventions and 3 pens.
Would you say that your undergraduate professors, that was kind of the first time, or even in high school, that you were, or even from an early age, you were allowed to think outside the box?
I would say undergraduate school, Drexel was a cooperative education program, Northeastern University, others. So it took 5 years to complete your bachelor's degree, but 18 months of that time was in industry paid to do a job. For example, I worked on railway systems, rapid transit, which ended up to be the BART system in San Francisco. I worked on the Poseidon submarine-launched missile at age 21, which we could never say, but has 7 nuclear warheads, which now we can say. And I ran computers and did things and saw the power of computers and of electronics and of working for and with very smart people. So I gravitated to working with people who were way smarter than me, because there's a saying, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
I like that one. If someone had met you at 25, what would they have misunderstood about your trajectory?
Well, thank you for doing 25 and not 19 or 21, because I was a dweeb and a nervous and insecure with women. Thank you for the forgiveness spirit. By the age 25, because I was born in 46, let me do the quick math, by 1971, 72, 73, I had published a first paper. I had presented at a conference. I had designed electronics that is still operational in the Navy today.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I, just like an Erector set or a toy or Tinker Toys, building things physically, whether they be physical or mechanical or electronic, primarily they were electronic, gave me a lot of satisfaction because I could do things that other people wouldn't attempt. Oh, what is this thing called a transistor or an integrated circuit? Or this problem is too hard, you can't do it. I took that as a challenge. What I teach, and I was an adjunct professor for 20 years and a full professor for two at a university, and I'm now a mentor. I teach people to not accept the word no. When someone tells you no, it means they don't know how to tell you yes. So I teach them to turn the no into a yes if, satisfy the if, and you're left with a yes. I learned that early on and was able to work with people much senior than I who wanted something done, didn't know how to do it, and gave me the freedom and the leeway to have 8 inventions and 3 patents.
Okay. That's quite a trajectory. You've worked in academia, defense, and the private sector. Which of those environments challenged your integrity or imagination the most, and how did you adapt?
All 3 of those. Let me do it backwards. I left all 3 due to a conflict between my understanding of ethics and the superiors above me. I left academia when the president of a college wanted me to pass on my doctoral student when she was nowhere near ready and could get the work. But the professor said, we need a graduate in order to finalize her accreditation. I said, fine, but here's why she's not ready. And he foolishly said, I thought you worked for me, which is something no one should ever accept. Slavery was abolished, 14th Amendment, I think. And I said, tell you what, I think we're done here. You can take them over. You don't have to pay me for today. Take me off your information as being a faculty member. We're done. I left government when, at age 40 in 1987, when the people around me also demonstrated ethics that conflicted with the way I was raised. And so I left without any pension. My mother, who grew up during the Depression, had no idea, by the way, what an engineer does, said, well, did you get a pension? I said, no, Ma, 18 and a half years. She said, work another year and a half. And I said, Mom, that's military. Yes, I attended 2 military colleges, but including NPS. But as a civilian, I'd have to go to age 55. I'm 40. So she said, whatever you think best. And I left SAIC as a C-level officer on the board in the annual report when people above me lied about me to the president of the company and it caused a conflict. So I said, I'm out of here. And I left, and a year later, formed my own company and worked 10 years. So working for very smart people is important. I don't want to be the smartest person in the room. I can learn every day from everybody. I'm learning from this interview how to conduct an interview. And I like a challenge, but I like a chance. I don't like an impossible situation. I like a difficult situation. Hamming gave a quote, which I love. Hamming would sit at Bell Labs before he came to NPS. He was 30 years at AT&T Bell Labs. And he would sit with the physicists or the mathematicians or the chemists and say, what's the most important problem in your area? When they answered, then he would say, well, what are you working on? And when they had answered that, he'd say, why aren't they the same? He encouraged people to work on important problems. Hamming encouraged me to work on important problems. That's what I've done in my career.
So is that how you are able to advance your own version of ethics and morals when they don't coincide with others?
To an important problem in a different domain.
Yeah. Okay. I like that.
Ethics and truthfulness are mandatories in a relationship between me and a coworker and a boss. If someone doesn't demonstrate ethics, if someone lies to someone else in my presence, they're history. I have no reason to continue with them. I leave.
Well, then, going to your working with Richard Hamming, this is actually fairly interesting to me. I haven't had a chance to kind of tell you my background yet, but I'm in the Navy currently, and I am a meteorology and oceanography officer. And I'm here doing my PhD in meteorology. One of the things that we do, I can't even tell you how many hours, both with master's and with my PhD here, work on the supercomputer that is named Hamming. Yeah, Hamming supercomputer. So it's a daily dose of Hamming, basically, for me every time that I log on to my computer. So this is a very cool moment, very cool interview for me. And I'd love to hear what you have to say in this next couple of sections. So you were mentored directly by Richard Hamming. What did it actually feel like to be guided by someone who didn't just value brilliance, but demanded it?
I need to back up a little bit. When I arrived here in September of 77, Professor Don Kirk was the head of the electrical engineering department, and he was the one who admitted me as a Navy civilian on a Department of the Navy fellowship. I was a GS-12. I was not married, and so I lived here in Herman Hall, and as a consequence, had no outside distractions, which helped me. Because while I was given a 12-month fellowship, that wasn't enough to complete a PhD. So I overloaded and took 4 courses my first semester, 6 courses my second semester, plus language at DLI. Back then it was required, and then 4. So I finished all my coursework in 9 months. But I had already had, as you say, 2 master's degrees, 1 directly relevant. And I came with a real-world problem. I foolishly, having never picked a doctoral advisor, picked Cindy Parker, who had been the head of the electrical engineering department before Don Kirk, and had had the most of the successful doctoral candidates. And I thought, well, might as well go with a success. He knows what he's doing. I had no experience in picking a doctoral advisor, and I picked not wisely, as they say. He was a theorist and I was an experimentalist. I came with a real-world problem that needed a real-world experimental answer because the theories had failed. It related to the Navy Mark 48 torpedo, which had a Kalman filter.
I actually used to own those.
Yes, I understand. And the Kalman filter does a linear model approximation to the acoustics. The torpedo would either listen passively or ping actively. The signal would come back from the target and the surface and the bottom. It's called multipath. And using a Kalman filter and an approximate to the real world of a linear filter, they were able to have the submarine find the target. The problem was 1 out of 10 times it didn't work, and the torpedo would veer into the bottom and explode, alerting the enemy that they're under attack. Not a good thing.
It's not our goal.
No, it's not our goal. And so I learned this 2 years earlier when I was a student at the Naval War College. So I came here with the idea that, the real world is not linear. The real world is nonlinear. But we didn't have any nonlinear techniques nor computing power to solve it. Well, that was my problem. Systematic experimental determination of discrete time models for nonlinear systems mean how do you build a discrete model?
I actually followed that. That's crazy. Okay.
And how do you apply it to both the general thing and the Mark 48 torpedo? And I was able to do that, but only experimentally, starting on the computers here. I did not get out into acoustic trials, but someone else did, and that caused a mod in the Mark 48 torpedo, and the Mark 48 torpedo no longer uses the Kalman filter because it doesn't work.
Interesting. Okay.
So that was one of the contributions out of my dissertation. How did I find Hamming? How did Hamming find me?
How was it working with
him? With Parker, it wasn't working. The late Dr. Parker was a theorist. He did not trust computers or software programming. So he wasn't excited about my experimental results. He wanted me to do necessary and sufficient conditions in theory forms the way he had been taught years earlier. Didn't apply to my problem. I wasn't interested. He determined that, therefore, I wasn't going to graduate under him. And at 31 years old, that would have eliminated my career by the Navy lab who sent me here. So I went to Dr. Don Kirk and said, here's my problem. Kirk said, I understand. Let's get you another advisor. And he talked to Dick Hamming and said, Dick, I have the student. I know you don't want any doctoral students. Hamming had already won the Turing Award, which is the Nobel Prize of Mathematics, in 1968. So this was 1978, 10 years later. Hamming is here.
And you're still his first doctoral student, or you became?
He had 1 or 2 master's students, which I've had 2 master's students and 1 doctoral student. They're much easier. Doctoral student is a longer term relationship where you're really advancing science. You're doing research. many master's theses, and I have two as examples, are really engineering or a more basic analysis rather than in generally doing world-class research. World-class research hopefully happens at the doctoral level, on occasion at the master's level, but mine did not. So Hamming didn't want a doctoral student. That was one of the conditions when he came here. But he was intrigued by the problem that I had and the mathematics involved and the fact that I was doing experimental work, which turns out to have been somewhat related to what he had done at Bell Labs, unknown to me. And so he tested me. He said, Professor Parker wanted you to prove uniqueness, meaning when you create a model of a system, it's a unique model, and you failed to satisfy him. And I said, yes, Professor Hamming. And he stopped and said, well, if you can't prove it's true, can you demonstrate it's false? It took me 2 weeks to find two counterexamples of two equations which looked totally different that produced the identical output for any input. So uniqueness doesn't exist when you model. And he said, that's good. And then he inquired of the other professors whose courses I'd taken. I had reasonably good grades, not straight A's, but primarily A's. And he says, okay, I'll take you as my doctoral student. That started a 3-year effort. Under his tutelage, I learned when something didn't work, why didn't it? When the math that came out of the computer was different than what I expected, why? When you invert a matrix and all of a sudden you lose accuracy, why? That's what he wanted me to do, because a scientist needs to understand the results of the experiment, not that the experiment succeeded or failed. Why did it fail? What can you learn from that? Is there value in failure? Some of the many things Hamming taught me, and just to finish up your answer to the question, Hamming believed in working on important problems. He recognized a nonlinear filter modeling technique was valuable. He liked the power of the computer and the fact that I was programming the computer here. And he liked the fact that I wasn't giving up and rolling over. And so he said, move on. And before I knew it, time was up and I had to go back to Connecticut. And before the internet and before the IBM PC, I did my research in Connecticut and sent him results by postal mail, ultimately by a very low-speed modem for communications, but we didn't have the internet. We didn't have the IBM PC during my time here. And I would come out here about every 3 months and sit down with him and go over my results, and he would ask questions. I do recall on one occasion I had used some techniques to try to build a model. And when you only have finite information to go into the model, you have zero values before then. It's called windowing. Well, how do you start up the model if you don't have the past? And a very famous window is named after Richard Hamming, called the Hamming window.
We're taught about that in our classes.
Exactly. When I explained, here are three different windowing techniques, and here's the one I recommend, and it wasn't the Hamming filter. And he looked at me and said, Mr. Mandelberg, are you telling me that the Hamming filter, which was named by the great statistician John Tukey, is suboptimal? And I swallowed and I said, yes, Professor Hamming. And he smiled and said, good job. I was able to speak truth to power.
So that actually answers my next question, which was there a moment in your advising relationship where you felt outmatched or uncertain? And then what helped you refine your footing? It seems like there might have been multiple times, but Hamming appreciated the fact that you were willing to go against.
He appreciated the fact that I was working on an important problem in a newer way, using the power of the computers, which he was famous for, using numerical techniques that others here at NPS and the Navy had not yet chosen to use. When I challenged what the computers were doing and the middleware, there's something called MATLAB and STATLAB.
I'm MATLAB intensively.
Back then, it was version 1.0. Well, the early MATLAB and STATLAB, I experimentally determined, had errors in it, just like Microsoft operating system. It gets patched every week, right? Well, before MATLAB got patched, it would make errors. And unless you looked for them, you didn't know it. I discovered the errors in MATLAB and STATLAB, showed it to him, and says, okay, what are you going to do about it? Well, I wrote my own MATLAB, and I inverted the matrix with math that didn't have the same errors at MATLAB. So one of my findings were, you need to know your software better than most people. You just don't use it blindly. And I also evolved to the faster, better virtual computers, virtual memory. When I started my dissertation inverting 100 by 100 matrices, the IABM mainframe here had 128 kilobytes of main memory and 2 megabytes of magnetic core disk. I'm sorry, rotating disk. I apologize. It was magnetic core memory, magnets and wires was the primary one thing, a rotating disk with 2 megabytes. My Samsung phone has 256 gigabytes right. of primary memory and a 4 terabyte secondary memory. Back in the day, in the late 70s, early 80s, I was against the limit of a computer, but I found a way out of it. And then digital equipment came out with virtual memory on the VAX 11780. And all of a sudden, I had enough computing power and I could breeze through the rest of my experiments at an accelerated rate with better accuracy. So I was able to produce results, which he liked. And he still challenged me. And he challenged me in a way that I wish more professors would do. When I had felt I was close to the end, he says, okay, show me your technique. So I would create a synthetic system, put in random inputs, get the random outputs, take that system away, just take the inputs and outputs, and then go into my program and compare all of the techniques from Kalman filtering to Volterra modeling to other techniques to come up with a model and use least mean squared error or and or other conditions to create a nonlinear dynamic model. And he saw me demonstrate it and saw that the results showed that the technique that I had developed was at least an order of magnitude better. And he said, okay, get out of the room. And he created a system and he used my program and modeled it. He basically did IV and V. And he says, okay, good, go to the department head. And Dr. Don Kirk, who was at Lincoln Labs on the East Coast, came to my house. He independently IV and V'd my results. Hamming said, okay, finish your write-up. You're ready for your defense.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at tridentroompodcasthost@nps.edu.